No, I forgot to text him. All right, welcome everyone to the April 13th, 2026 Minnesota House of Representatives Transportation Finance and Policy Committee hearing. We'll let Scraba continue to pass out goodies to everybody while I make sure that I, the committee chair, maintain control of these proceedings and establish the following expectations. Signs and placards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, and disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed, and for safety reasons, standing or sitting walkways and aisles or standing or obstructing at your chair is prohibited. If you require any accommodation, please speak with the sergeant staff. Troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given specific time limits, which must be strictly observed. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct these proceedings efficiently while ensuring everyone has the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. So thank you very much, everybody, for being here. First item is approval of the minutes from April 8th. Chair Kosnick.
Thank you. Before we do that, the feng shui in the room is off. If I could have Representative Scraba pick up that napkin that was dropped. I organized some chairs behind the testifiers earlier. Chair Tabke, I would move, would move the minutes for April 8th, 2026.
Chair Kosnick moves approval of the minutes for April 8th, 2026. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? The minutes are approved, and thank you very much, Representative Scraba. First item on our list today is House File 3373. Representative Hansen has St. Paul Park. Our first bill, I move House File 3373 be in front of the committee. This bill will be laid over. So, Chair Hansen, please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 3373 relates to an intersection in my district, and I have two very capable testifiers that are going to be here. I would ask probably the best way to describe this interchange is if you look at this packet that was just handed out and turn it onto the back page, and the interchange looks like either a hook or a claw, depending on your perspective. That interchange backs up, and as growth continues to occur in Washington County, and we have the refinery traffic, that strange-looking interchange fills up with vehicles, and it fills up fast and with a lot of them. And so we're asking here for trunk highway bonds from the Trunk Highway Fund for preliminary design and final design at this interchange. We realize that you may or may not have a bill, but we would certainly appreciate any support you could provide. And with that, I have with me Mayor Keith Franke and Washington County Commissioner Carla Bigham. I believe that because Mayor Franke brought the brownies, he will be going first.
Thank you very much, Mayor Franke, for the brownies. And please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Tabke and committee. Mayor Keith Franke, St. Paul Park, Minnesota. So this bill comes out of an idea. I'm going to try and be as short as possible, but there's a story behind it. I don't know how many of you have been down to the South Metro in our area. This all starts back to the Wakota Bridge project. And when the Wakota Bridge was redesigned, the interchange at Glen Road in Newport was designed to handle all the truck traffic and traffic. The interchange at 70th Street in St. Paul Park was not designed. And as it was told to me by previous mayors, the initial plans by MnDOT when they did the Wakota Bridge project did not include interchange for St. Paul Park. Therefore, we were going to lose our interchange and essentially cut off our city, and people would either have to have gone through Newport or back through Cottage Grove to get to our city. So through some political maneuvering, they were able to get the 70th Street interchange back. But to my understanding, once again, I was not there. They were told, this is the interchange you're going to get. You get what you get, and don't pitch a fit. Since then, growth in our area, especially Cottage Grove, Newport's growing. St. Paul Park is growing. The interchange is woefully undersized. The one of the biggest problems, not only is it because of the traffic, but safety. We have the one of our two refineries in our state is in my city, Marathon Refining. And the truck traffic was initially designed to go through the Glen Road interchange, which is oversized and more designed with larger roads, larger turn lanes, everything like that. But when you come back to the 70th Street interchange, it was not designed for that. And when they're coming out of the refinery, the trucks are going uphill, which really slows down traffic. So years ago, shortly after 9/11, there was some worries and concerns. And once again, I don't know how that went because it was before I was ever involved in the political realm or even a business realm. But the refinery closed off part of its roadway where the trucks used to go down 4th Avenue in Newport. And the other roads in Newport have truck restrictions. So the semi trucks full of petroleum and everything else cannot get out the way they were designed to through the Glen Road Exchange. So now they get pushed through into my city into an undersized, underdeveloped uphill, and it pushes all the rest of the traffic back. And with all the increase in traffic from the potential growth, people become impatient. Now, the latest iteration in the last couple of years has been we have the coming off of 61 South, there's now was a no turn on red. So cars can't just turn and then potentially, because the semis are coming slow, trying to come up the hill. We are seeing there's a potential, it's not if, it's when, we have a development coming in St. Paul Park that's almost gonna double us in size. And traffic already backs up in this interchange, blocks back into town, and then depending upon the time of day, down the ramp, coming up into town, because you can not only get to St. Paul Park with this interchange, you can get to Cottage Grove to the left and go up 70th Street or 65th, which then also takes you into Newport. All these areas are growing. Cottage Grove is set to develop one of the largest developments here in Twin Cities history coming up. Not that this interchange will impact that, but some of it will, because people learn to maneuver and get around, and hey, it's easier to duck up 70th Street than go all the way down to 19 or cut up 80th. So these issues right now are only a problem during peak problems, peak times of traffic, you know, in the morning, in the afternoon. One of my biggest concerns, again, not only is it traffic flow and ease of life for our citizens, but it is the safety. We have letters of support in the packet that was provided to you from all the cities around, Cottage Grove, Newport, St. Paul Park. I've even had discussions with Marathon Refinery, and they are understanding of the fact that this is an issue and it's only going to get worse. They are even willing to potentially through discussions, like, what can we do to help? So they're not standing on the sidelines. They're willing to take part in the discussion. They're even like, depending upon how the pre-design goes, we own some of that land right along there. We would be willing to give up that land, you know, however we need to. So I've also taken this and had discussions with our congressperson, Angie Craig. So she's aware of it. I've put it on her radar. Now, depending upon how elections go, but no matter what position anybody's in, I see this as a major issue coming to our area sooner than later, and I'm trying to bring everybody involved to the table, everybody here at the Capitol, the legislature, the cities, the counties, our federal partners, and our larger business partners to attack this, and I'm more than happy to, you know, spearhead this, because I see it's a problem that is definitely going to be needing a fix. So
got
stand for any questions. Thank you, Chair Tabke. Thank you to the committee for listening.
Thank you very much. We'll go now to Commissioner Bigham. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Carla Bigham. I'm the Washington County Commissioner for this particular area in Washington County, and I am here to support House File 3373 and also the mayor, because most of you know in this room, it's good to be mayor. And when they call, you better answer. So I do want to give additional context to what the mayor has already testified to. But the Highway 61 and Summit Avenue is the primary access point for Marathon Refinery. And it's, I think, the third largest in the Midwest oil refinery. And the volume of traffic from that company on top of aggregate, which you need to use to, you know, build roads, carry a significant traffic count and put a lot of pressure on our traffic in this area and the congestion. It is, as the mayor said, an interchange that is very closely spaced, and it is, has, let's see, a light and restrictions on the light, as the mayor said, but also just the spacing of it is very close. And I would encourage you all to take a drive down there. We're about 10 miles down the highway, and rumor has it that there's a really good cafe on Broadway, just saying. I also want to make a broader point to the committee, is that the operational challenges don't stop here at this interchange. Basically, from Newport, which is the Maxwell Bailey exit, down 61 all the way to the Hastings border, it's a huge safety issue. We've had just a couple weeks ago, on March 28th, an 80-year-old woman was killed northbound on Highway 61. And a year ago, a driver died crashing on the southbound ramp on 70th Street. And then over the last couple of years, we've had other fatalities. So it's just becoming more and more dangerous because of the growth in the area. And we really do need this study to look at how we can bring all the parties together, as the mayor said, and figure out how to fix this area because it is rapidly growing both residentially and in industry. So I will stand for any questions if you have them.
Very much, Commissioner. Any questions for the bill author? Representative Anderson.
Thank you. First of all, it's great to see you. It's former legislator day, right? So I just want to tell the member, I know this area. It's in Washington County, and it is as bad as they say. So I just want you to know that. So thank you.
Any others? Chair Kosnick, do you have anything to add on this?
No, other than welcome back to the committee and the legislature, but obviously it's an open appropriation. What are we talking about in terms of ballpark or cost?
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Chair Kosnick, 500.
Chair Kosnick.
1,000? Million?
1,000.
And Mr. Chair, last week we had a discussion on mitigating greenhouse gas, higher emission standards. Is this project subject to one of those as well?
Chair Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Chair Kosnick, I believe that's the statute. So the design and pre-design would be building in according to current law.
Chair Kosnick.
Well, Commissioner Bingham was here, and I appreciate that you're back. Be curious if there's the suggestion that maybe that she had put in there that keeping the cost down, this could be one of the first projects that would have an exemption written into law. But we'll just leave it there and lay the bill over.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. Has this interchange been worked on or studied at all prior? I mean, this Marathon has a very compelling letter, and it's kind of like, okay, everybody knows there's a lot of traffic at these refineries. Did anyone anticipate that much more traffic, or what happened, and how did it get so congested all at once, or seems like at once?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question.
Mr. Bingham.
When the light restriction went on with the no right turn, I believe there was a very, and I'm not an engineer, but just your normal, basic, middle of the road, no pun intended, study, but not a comprehensive one that would be needed to figure out because of the short spacing in between the overpass and then going into the commercial area, residential area, and then heading into county roads. It would need a much, much more comprehensive approach.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scraba, I think the Wakota Bridge project was a decades-long project, decades. And I think, you know, what happens with decades-long projects is once they're done, you're kind of like, well, we're done, right? And then the growth occurs, the volume of work occurs, not just, you know, this isn't planning for additional growth. We got additional growth already that's happened. And the changes that have occurred with the design for dealing with the refinery traffic have changed. They've changed with safety and so you have that. You've got Gray Cloud Island also, township developing, the aggregate moving on that, growth in population. So you have a combination of factors that continue slowly happening year after year. And that's why I think the design and pre-design is good for us to get this looked at right now, and how do we actually get the engineering done, because it's kind of a glacial, very big movement that has been happening, and all of a sudden it's here.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question. You mentioned, Mayor, that development, you know, you're having some major expansions going on. Is it housing? What is it that that's being added, and is it adjacent to this area?
Mayor Frankie.
Thank you, Chair Tabke. Representative, it's mainly housing, so it's going to be a lot of traffic that's expanding. The refinery has no room to expand. For the understanding, when the Commissioner and Representative Hansen speak to aggregate, I'm not sure if people understand. We also have a mine, and I forgot to mention that, down in Gray Cloud. And that mine runs tons and tons of aggregate up and down one of our main streets that we're redeveloping right now, and right up through the same interchange on the same roads. And so you'll have petroleum trucks and aggregate trucks just backed up, and then trying to turn basically onto uphill road with citizens and regular traffic trying to cross both ways. So as far as a study, the only thing I saw was basically a traffic count study, not necessarily a flow study or how can we redesign this because of the growth and the changes that are coming. Because, like I said, the initial thought process was that this larger interchange at Glen Road was going to be able and could have potentially handled this traffic, but when the roads got closed to the truck traffic, it no longer goes that way. It comes through my town and then up 70th Street. Cottage Grove and Summit converge on a county road at that point of that interchange. So I think, you know, initially MnDOT and everybody thought that was going to continue. That's another unknown factor at the time of the design or the study or the implementation of the project, that a majority of this semi-traffic, and there's other larger industrial areas down in there through the backside of Newport and others, and there's cold storage companies and other stuff. When that happened.
Railroad.
And the railroad. That was made to be the design, but over time, that was closed off to truck traffic. Not the interchange, but the roads getting to the interchange. So now that interchange is not being used. All the trucks are coming up and around through some city roads onto the other interchange. So,
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up.
Well, we have to move on. Okay. So this is just being laid over, so you feel free to ask questions afterward. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mayor, for being here. Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Hansen, do you have any final words?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, House File 3373 is laid over. Thank you. Now we move to House File 4449. This bill will also be laid over today. So, Representative Jones, you have an A4 author's amendment after you get settled up there. Would you like to offer your A4 author's amendment?
I move my amendment.
A4 author's amendment is in front of us. Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Anyone opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Jones, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Tapke. Okay, good. I know how this works, maybe. Uh-oh. Did I just break it? Okay. Thank you, Chair Tabke and Chair Kosnick and members of the Transportation Committee to the opportunity to present House File H4449, what I'm calling Transit for Resilient Metro. So I actually want to start high level and ask three main questions. Do we want a growing Twin Cities, a metro that can compete with peers, and a place where businesses and residents can thrive? Hopefully to these questions, we're all saying yes. And even if you don't live in the metro, when the metro does well, it helps the whole state do well. So I hope we can agree that having transportation in order to make these things move helps build a bigger and greater metro. So we need reliable, affordable, and accessible transportation options to be able to get there. And it's no secret that most transportation used in the metro is by car. Cars should and will always be an option in Minnesota. But we have to acknowledge that there are some challenges. First, 1 in 3 Minnesotans cannot or does not have a car due to age, ability, cost, accessibility, or choice. That includes 1 in 5 seniors. This includes kids who want to get to friends' houses, school, sports, or the ice cream shop. This includes my friend who's in his 30s. He looks completely able-bodied, but epilepsy keeps him from being able to get a driver's license. All of these people matter. The other thing is that vehicle costs are increasing. The average new car costs $50,000. And Trump's ill-considered war is driving gas costs up with no relief in sight. Another thing is that a growing metro population requires us to be more efficient with the way we use our space. This image on the screen there shows 60 people in different modes of transportation and how much space that those 60 people would take up riding a bus, riding a bike, or driving in cars. Oops. So this bill creates a foundation to build the confidence and cost effectiveness in the transit system and to grow it to reach the needs of more people, because we need more options, and transit is a great one for that. Diving into the details, I see three important issues that are holding us back. One is a lack of numeric goals for Twin Cities Metro Area Transit System. The second one is inefficient coordination of road construction and transit projects. And the third one is inadequate tools for building a more effective transit system. And this bill seeks to address all three of these. So the first one, lack of numeric goals. So let's set some goals. The first one is to really pair ridership and frequency, because we know when frequency increases, it drives and improves ridership. So let's establish targets for residents with access to high frequency transit. So that means that over time, we want to increase the number of residents who have access to those fast buses and trains. The second one would establish average operating costs per passenger service per hour. And this would demonstrate effectiveness and drive confidence in the system. And the third metric would really help us get there faster, get people to places faster with transit by establishing speed and reliability metrics. The second issue is inefficient coordination of road construction projects and with transit projects. So this actually came to me in my own district. Lyndale Avenue is a road in my district. It's being reconstructed by the county next year. It's also on Metro Transit's plan tentatively for a BRT project in the next, 5 to 7 years. Well, it doesn't make sense to tear up the road in next year and then tear it up again in 5 to 7 years to put in the BRT project. So what we need is earlier knowledge of planned transit in a corridor so that cities, counties, and the state can better incorporate those transit elements into the projects as they're tearing up the road at that time. So the proposed solution, let's tear up the road only once. And we do that by creating a transit investment framework with accountability. So for those of you who are familiar with Metro Transit's current transportation policy plan, there is a framework that lays out what are the projects that we want in the metro going forward. The problem is it's kind of just been a wish list. And that's not to anyone's particular fault. That's just because of how funding and the incentive structure has existed in the past couple decades. And so now that transit funding is more stable, especially the operational funding, we can start to think more concretely about how do we build a comprehensive, holistic network. But we have to have accountability mechanisms with it. So this framework would essentially create a map of corridors where we want in the region to have transit. And this is incorporated as a part of the regional development guide. That essentially happens every 10 years. And just as it currently exists, there is an amendment process to allow necessary changes in between. That accountability mechanism comes in where it requires money that is spent on a substantial construction project along a corridor planned for transit to support the alignment of that transit need. So if we go back to that Lyndale Avenue example, because it's being built or reconstructed next year, it would make sense if we could just upgrade those bus stations with that project instead of waiting 5 to 7 years, upgrading them then, and having to tear up the road, inconveniencing everyone along that corridor. The way this would work is that noncompliance with this provision would be determined by a committee, and the members are spelled out in the bill. And the results would be that any noncompliance would be the funding reallocation to transit-supporting pots of funding. And I will note that I've been in conversations with basically all levels of government, state, county, city, and continue to want to explore how are we going to make this implementable. The third issue is inadequate tools for building a more cost-effective system. So transit is most cost-effective when we have lots of ridership, right? And when there's more ridership when there are people nearby the transit stations. So a good example is the Green Line. I ride the Green Line most days to get here. It's a fantastic transit. What could have been better was how quickly we were building the developments around those transit stops. So the picture on the right just shows that there was construction that didn't happen until 6 years after the stations were built. So it was kind of a missed opportunity for ridership for those first 6 years. So the proposed solution, so transit-oriented development is already a policy that Metro Transit and Met Council pursue. However, they can only incentivize it right now. What this bill does is it allows Met Council to buy and own property in order to develop that land as they see fit in order to support that transit-oriented development. So they could have an RFP in order to let the private market bid and develop that, or they can develop it themselves. It gives that flexibility, but really it's just giving it an allowance there. So that is my bill, and I stand for questions.
Thank you very much, Representative Jones. We have a couple of amendments that we will get to first and have discussion about the bill. Representative Olson, A3 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the A2 amendment, which is all about the prohibition does not apply to highway projects that are predominantly designed to address a documented safety issue. I think that whereas this bill has the best of intentions, there are some unintended consequences that I think that would result from an implementation of this. One of those biggest concerns of mine has and continues to always be the safety of our drivers, the safety of our pedestrians and our bikers, people out on the road. And if we are forcing communities to build a new bus stop or create a new bus lane in order to address a safety concern, we're talking about a substantial increase in the cost that this project would make to save people's lives or to potentially increase the safety of an area. And so my biggest concern is the idea of safety among people on the streets. And in order to do that, I want to make sure that we can have a conversation that includes making sure communities don't have to spend $85,000 for a new bus stop in order to put a stoplight up or to change an intersection, ensuring that they don't have to create a potentially $500,000 bus lane in order to save people's lives. So that's the entire intention of this amendment that I'm bringing forward, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Olson, for bringing this. I think you raise an important point, and I'd be happy to continue talking to you about this, because it is really important to me, too, that all of our residents and people on our streets are safe. The intention of this bill is really to get at those major construction projects, so really we're digging into the – we're changing out the concrete. And so when we're already spending that amount of money, like we should be incorporating all of those pieces at the same time. While I support the intention behind this, I don't support the amendment as it currently stands.
Closing comments, Representative Olson.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that we need to ensure that safety remains paramount to everything that we do here. And I think that, I guess, maybe the new amendment that Representative Jones brought in may in fact have some of those numbers that I was looking at, because you're talking major projects. I guess I didn't see that in the original bill that you're outlining, you know, something that costs $15 million or whatever, because that's a major project in the metro area. I didn't see that. But I think that as a result, we need to establish that safety remains an issue, remains a focal point of our committee. And as such, Mr. Chair, I would ask for a roll call on this amendment.
Oh, Representative Olson, I was just going to ask if, since Representative Jones agreed with you that she would like to continue working on this bill is being laid over and not moving forward today. There's still lots of time to work on things as things go. She agrees with you and wants to make this happen. And do you want to withdraw the amendment, or do you want a roll call on the amendment?
Well, I think that, Mr. Chair, if the author of the amendment or the bill is accepting of the concept of working on this amendment, we could adopt the amendment, and then we could work on it backwards, moving forward and then stepping back, as opposed to staying where we are and then trying to move forward. So I'd appreciate this amendment to be voted on.
Okay. Roll call having been requested, please take the roll.
Chair Tapke.
No.
Chair Tapke, no. Chair Kosnick.
Kosnick, aye.
Kosnick, aye. Vice Chair Ream.
No.
Ream, no. Vice Chair Myers.
Aye.
Myers, aye. Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Anderson, aye. Representative Fogelman.
Aye.
Fogelman, aye. Representative Green.
No.
Green, no. Representative Jones.
No.
Jones, no. Representative Joy.
Yes.
Joy, aye. Representative Cagle.
No.
Cagle, no. Representative Kraft.
No.
Kraft, no. Representative Luger-Nicolai.
No.
Luger-Nicolai, no. Representative Murphy.
Yes.
Murphy, yes. Representative Olson.
Yes.
Olson, yes. Representative Sensormiro.
No.
Sensormiro, no. Representative Scraba.
Aye.
Scraba, aye. Mr. Chair, the ayes are 8, the nays are 8.
With 8 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does not prevail. A3 amendment, Chair Kosnick.
Thank you. Great job presenting. A big concept. I think there's some merit to some of the stuff. One of the big things, though, is what this amendment will do, and I would move the A3 amendment for the record, is allows local cities to have more input, local elected officials to have the voice of their constituents and to look at individual projects, because projects may be vastly different or certain unique characteristics may come up. And so allows a local city to, by resolution, offer an opt-out of these requirements, or if the local city wants more broader input, they can put it on a referendum in a general election, and then their constituents in that particular city can weigh in if there's a particular issue that needs to be addressed or have more input on. And so what this does is allows local control for electeds to have input and say, and also for our local taxpayers and citizens that would hopefully be using the transit development in there. So that is the A3 amendment, kind of wrote over it, A3 amendment, and I would request a roll call as well.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Tapke, and thank you, Co-Chair Kosnick, for bringing this. I think you raise an important point about essentially where do we want future transit? And the reason for pairing both the metrics as well as the transit investment framework in this bill is that we want the metrics to be driving us essentially to the places where transit is desired. And so in some ways, the way we do that is by land use. And cities have this jurisdiction of determining land use. And so they're effectively signaling where they want transit by saying, yeah, we're going to have a lot of people here. And so it makes a lot of sense to put transit there. So if cities are not interested in transit, they won't do that type of land use planning. And so it would not make sense for that to end up into the transit investment framework. And the other part about the transit investment framework, it is part of an engagement process that, similar with the TPP, the Transportation Policy Plan, it is a region-wide stakeholder process. And so I don't see this, honestly, as becoming so much of an issue because cities will already be indicating with their land use that they want transit. And so I don't necessarily see the need for this amendment.
Final comment, Chair Kosnick.
Just maybe a more of a technical question. With the A4 amendment on page 2, looks like subdivision 4, 2.3 to 2.25, sets up a coordinating committee. And maybe just for my clarification and that of the committee and the public, doesn't this committee that you're setting up have a lot more influence and leeway on some of these projects that it has to go through this committee before a project could be built? Is that right?
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Co-Chair Tabke and Co-Chair Kosnick. This committee will essentially only review a project if it was raised that a project is not in alignment with essentially that's not building transit along a corridor that was planned for transit. So it's more of a it's not an approval. It's if something is inconsistent, then it gets discussed at that committee.
Chair Kosnick.
Thank you. I appreciate the clarification. Maybe that's helpful. I think we're putting a little bit more weight on this committee as opposed to the local electeds in some cases. And so, further, I have further issue with the makeup of that particular committee as well. But for the A3 amendment and sticking to that topic, I would rather trust our local electeds than the Met Council and their committee and MnDOT and all that. So I would request we adopt the A3 amendment.
Roll call has been requested on the A3 amendment.
Chair Tapke.
No.
Tapke, no. Chair Kosnick.
Kosnick, aye.
Kosnick, aye. Vice Chair Ream.
No.
Ream, no. Vice Chair Myers.
Aye.
Myers, aye. Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Anderson, aye. Representative Fogelman.
Aye.
Fogelman, aye. Representative Green.
No.
Green, no. Representative Jones.
No.
Jones, no. Representative Joy. Joy, aye. Representative Cagle.
No.
Cagle, no. Representative Kraft.
No.
Kraft, no. Representative Luger-Nicolai.
No.
Luger-Nicolai, no. Representative Murphy.
Yes.
Murphy, aye. Representative Olson.
Yes.
Olson, aye. Representative Centimero.
No.
Centimero, no. Representative Scraba.
Aye.
Scraba, aye. Mr. Chair, the ayes are 8, the nays are 8.
The motion does not prevail. All right, we have a few testifiers. We'll start out with Commissioner Brennan from Scott County.
Thank you so much for allowing me to speak today. I am Jody Brennan. I'm a county commissioner representing the city of Shakopee on the Scott County Board, and I represent the same area as Chair Tapke, and I'll say Shakopee's in the house today. So, first, I want to be fair to the authors of this bill. Today's amendments that were brought forward would have been an agreeable amendment for this bill. Scott County has transportation sales tax projects underway that our residents had voted for and are counting on us to deliver. Under this bill, any of those projects would have been found inconsistent with a transit framework that counties had limited input in writing. If that happens, the sales tax revenues those same residents voted on to dedicate to county roads gets redirected to the Metropolitan Council. No appeal and no meaningful county voice in the decisions that trigger a penalty. The safety carve-out matters. but clear documentation standards so counties can actually rely on it and not just hope for the best when the roads need urgent attention. Cities receive an opt-out mechanism under these amendments. Counties do not. That's not equitable. As for the transit-oriented development zoning mandates, not one of the amendments did touch on them. Counties and cities are still prohibited from spending on transit capital projects unless local zoning conforms to standards with a geographic scope that remains undefined. That bypasses the local elected officials and compromises plan processes our communities have spent years developing. Scott County wants to be a real partner in coordinating transit and roadway investments. We're not here to obstruct what's going on. We're here because the people I represent need both a functional transportation system and a voice in the decisions that are governing it. We ask this committee to ensure counties have meaningful influence in framework development, a genuine opt-out equivalent to what cities receive, a formal appeal process for any penalty that's informed, and a defined geographic scope for the transit-oriented development requirements before this bill moves forward. And I understand that's late hour. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. Next up, we'll have Commissioner Green from Hennepin County. And following that would be MJ Carpio from Move Minnesota. Commissioner Green, please introduce yourself and proceed for the record.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Co-Chair Tabke, Co-Chair Kosnick, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Marion Green, and I'm the Hennepin County Commissioner for District 3, and I'm the chair of the Regional Railroad Authority. Thank you, Representative Jones, for bringing this forward and for this committee's attention to this important matter. Minnesotans need affordable transportation options, and that includes a robust and efficient transit network. It remains essential for our economy and family budgets. State, local, and federal investment supports high-quality transit in our region, and we must work collaboratively to deliver that high-quality multimodal network. Minnesota households are struggling to stretch their incomes to meet their needs. Transit provides an affordable option for people to access better-paying jobs, education, and opportunity. Lack of transit or inefficient transit makes driving the only choice for most Minnesotans, causing more congestion in the metro, impacting energy consumption and air quality that drives up costs for Minnesotans. Our workforce wants to live in connected communities that provide multimodal transportation options. Major employers and developers know this and locate near high-quality transit. In fact, more than 35% of development in the Twin Cities region has occurred in high-frequency transit corridors since 2005, including $13 billion near existing and planned light rail station, with more in the pipeline. Transit projects themselves create thousands of good-paying jobs in Minnesota by leveraging billions in federal funds. These jobs become strong, lasting careers that strengthen the middle class and spur reinvestment in every part of our state. So, to HF 4449. Hennepin County spent years advocating for significant transit funding at the legislature, and in 2023, the legislature made generational investments in our transportation system. Critically, this legislation added new funding to improve safety and active transportation, and dedicated transit funding to build and operate a more efficient transit system. A lot of work remains for our region to complete a regional transit network that meets our growing needs. Planners and elected officials from local, state, and federal levels must work with community and business leaders to develop and advance a vision for an integrated regional transit system to connect our communities. Counties are fundamental partners in developing this vision. House File 4449 is a good step in moving towards achieving this vision together as a region to find efficiencies and work collaboratively to meet our needs. Hennepin County would like to remain a part of this conversation and ensure there's a balanced approach and engagement with local elected leaders and community. Again, we want to thank Representative Jones for starting this important conversation and giving us a template to work on. I look forward to further conversations on this issue. Let's keep the momentum going for fast, frequent, multimodal, integrated, and accessible transit system that will carry Minnesota into its brightest future. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Commissioner. Next up, we have MJ Carpio from Move Minnesota.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Tabke, for the opportunity to testify. My name is MJ Carpio, Executive Director of Move Minnesota, and we fight for Minnesotans who want access to convenient and affordable transportation options. We know from public polling that one-third of Minnesotans would be more likely to use public transit if there were greater access where they lived. And we also know that 64% of Twin Cities residents say that more frequent train and bus service would make them more likely to use public transit. And as the cost burden of car ownership continues to rise, Minnesotans want to choose affordable ways to travel around their communities. And in 2023, we took that first step toward building a nation-leading transit system by establishing the long-term dedicated funding for transit. So the next natural step is ensuring that those resources that we have invested are used well to expand people's access to fast and frequent service. So HF 4449, or Transit for a Resilient Metro, it would mandate that the Met Council set transit performance measures and create an investment framework aligned with improving service, increasing ridership, and centering transit-oriented development. And so by setting clear and ambitious goals, we can ensure that our public funds are actually being used to build and maintain a high-quality public transit system that meets the needs of our communities and maybe puts us on a world stage, who knows. So the three things I wanted to highlight were the performance measures. The performance measures are progressive benchmarks to expand convenient transit, and they should increase service reliability and speed to reduce travel times for riders. They should increase the number of people with access to high-frequency service, and they should decrease the average operating cost per passenger trip. So these are all pretty progressive and ambitious goals. The second piece is the transit system investment framework, which directs the Met Council to identify the expanded transit coverage and system improvements necessary to meet the performance measures. And it's great too that it's going to have continue to have community input. So that's great. And the third thing that I wanted to highlight is that we're encouraging transit-oriented development so that transit capital projects use transit-oriented design planning and that the Met Council will have a more active participation in developing and lands along bus, rapid transit, and light rail routes. And that's great. And I think the last thing I'll say is that this is setting an example for other agencies in Minnesota that to set performance measures and to really make sure that we're using our investments well that we fought really hard for. So thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify who hasn't yet? All right, seeing none, questions for Representative Jones. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Instead of, a long back and forth of multiple different questions of me asking and then responding, and I'm just going to get them all out right away because I've got three questions / concerns of this, whereas I think, like I said before, this bill has like the best of intentions in it. I really like the concept of providing some metrics saying we want to decrease the cost of ridership, we want to increase utilization. There's nothing more frustrating than driving past a city bus that's actually in service, running its route, and has no one on it. So there's nothing more frustrating than that. And so my three concerns here is the first one, obviously safety, still a major concern since we didn't adopt that amendment. The second one is the transit routes, they're really long and they go through all sorts of communities, all sorts of cities. And how does that affect if one of these areas or one of these communities are not complying with the plan and thus losing funding or thus being, reprimanded in some way, shape or form? How does that affect the entire establishment of this route? So that's question two. Number three concern / question is the population density requirements that we have in this bill, in my mind, hinders the build out of transit in our metro area. Obviously the way it kind of looks to me in this bill is we're pushing all the transit money into the core and all of our suburban counties are going to suffer as a result. And I think individuals like Representative Tabke, Representative Ream are going to be hurt by this push of transit funds into the core because that's where the population density is. So I commend you on the concept of creating a metric that we want to improve our ridership, we want to decrease the cost. But those three issues, the issues of safety, the transit routes with individuals not complying, and then the population density requirements that are going to push them into the core and take money away from the outer suburban areas that need this kind of transit just as much as anyone else. Those are the three.
Mm-hmm. I always appreciate you looking out for me. Thank you. Representative Jones.
Thank you, Chair Tabke and Representative Olson. These are great questions, so I'll maybe answer them in reverse order. So regarding the population piece, quite frankly, the urban core is pretty much already well-served. We already meet those metrics, so actually the targets that are in there are actually trying to indicate to cities that we want to serve you more, so therefore please create the land use conditions such that we can make transit more accessible to more people. Because right now, Minneapolis-St. Paul, we're already getting the high-frequency transit. I want it to get to other people. And we need the problem that we continue to face is this siloing of land use and transportation. And I'm open to new other ideas of how to bridge that. But this seemed to be an option for us to get there. And so, again, I'm really open to conversation. I just want us to bridge that gap. Secondly, the long routes to with transit, you raise a really good point. I want this to be a starter conversation. And as I mentioned, I've been talking with every level of government, and I want to continue to be able to do that so that we can address, you know, in my case with Lindale Avenue, it's already starting in the downtown core. It's okay if that is upgraded in terms of its bus service, but probably it doesn't make sense if it's in Bloomington and then actually the corridor, you know, anyway, the upgrade would happen in Bloomington way before it would happen in Minneapolis, for example, without the buses actually being there. So that just needs to be a continued conversation. And the safety piece as well, like I said, this is intended to be for the real major construction projects. And so, like, if there needs to be bump outs, there needs to be a light change. Like, that is not what is intended in this bill, and I'm happy to make changes for that.
You have a quick follow-up?
I just wanted to respond and be like, I appreciate that. I'm a logistics officer in the Army Reserve right now, and the concept of getting more people to the battlefield on the right place at the right time is something that I hold dearly. And so I appreciate the answers. I think there's a lot of work we can do to tighten things up, make it happen. But I like the idea of creating some metrics and saying, we need to make sure that we're only paying this much money per person riding this bus or riding this train, and how do we do that? And so I appreciate the intent of this. I think some of the unintended consequences need to be tightened up before we allow it to move forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We're going to do Representative Scraba, then Representative Kraft, then we're going to lay this over. So anybody else who has questions, please work with the author on that. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair Tapke. Representative Jones, two questions. Safety was my first thing I wrote down when I listened to you. My first thought was, like, safety has to be part of it. We're addressing that. One of the things the county commissioner from Scott County said was the opt-out, that cities get to opt-out, but counties can't. And I'd like to explain that, if you can. And my second question, your comment was the Met Council would just buy the land, like, to coordinate the properties, like if it's all private and it's all helter-skelter, trying to get it all coordinated, and the bill here, acquisition of property for transit-oriented development, I think is that kind of in that same, what I'm talking to is, so the concern I have is in any housing, as we find out, there's always, it doesn't make money all the time. So when government gets involved in buying housing and running it, someone's subsidizing it. The federal government does a lot of HRA stuff, but it's meant for that. And how are you going to address that when you're moving all the pieces in that puzzle? Thank you,
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Scraba. I may again answer in reverse order. So this graphic may help that a little bit. So I think, you know, we're talking about transit-oriented development, so we're trying to, or the intent would be to allow Metro Transit to essentially buy those properties adjacent to that T in the middle to be able to do mixed-use development, things like that. Right now, the bill allows flexibility, so Met Council might own the land, but then, you know, just lease it out to someone to then develop, and then they run it. or it could be subsidized housing. Right now, it allows for flexibility along that continuum, and I'm open to tightening that up as makes sense. And then secondly, I honestly did not quite understand the commissioner from Scott County's point about cities being able to opt out, but counties can't. I mentioned to her I wanted to talk with her afterwards because I wanted to understand a little bit more.
All right, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Jones, for bringing this. I want to commend you on putting this out on our agenda, this kind of long-term, very thoughtful thinking, building in accountability. I, too, like Representative Olson, I really love the idea of having clear metrics, ridership accounted, so I think that's fantastic. And I think you're pulling in high frequency is so important. And the thing I want to point out to folks is when you change over from needing to check a bus or light rail schedule to being able just to go because you know there's going to be one there very soon, it's a mind shift change that really drives further usage. And if you want any example of that, look at Brampton, Ontario, which has 700,000 people and like 260,000 rides a day of transit, all by focus on high frequency. So thank you for that. A question I have for you, on safety, I too am extremely concerned about safety, but it is my understanding, and maybe you can refresh my memory, that if you look at transit versus more time in a car versus other things, doesn't the fact of increasing investment in transit have a significant impact on safety and reduce death because of it's just a far safer approach?
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kraft. It's true. Transit has one of the lowest fatality rates out of any mode of transportation.
Chair Koznick.
Thank you. And again, thank you for presenting the topic and bringing this forward. One of the things, maybe I know what your thoughts would be, but you talked about every level of government and just kind of looking through the bill, I've been around long enough where at 3.26, 2.7, and 2.8, that language is reiterated throughout the bill. And what that language is it applies to the Met Council. That's how we define the Met Council and the seven counties in the metro area. But talking to every level of government, if this is such a good idea, why aren't we doing it throughout the state because in the other MPOs? And I'm guessing you probably haven't talked to all the other MPOs about this. The second point was we heard from our testifiers, Hennepin County, talk about affordability, and absolutely right. People are struggling with their own personal budgets as we have other inflationary pressures, the cost of goods and services, and I just want to throw it out to the committee that there's a proposal to raise the cost of many goods and services in Hennepin County another 1%, which would mean the sales tax would be, in many cases, over 10%.
Chair Koznick, let's keep to the bill, please.
That's what I'm talking about. Talking about the testifier that testified
Proceed.
About the bill and the affordability. And
Proceed. Just
thank
keep
you.
To the bill. Thank you.
So the point is that how does raising the cost of goods and services over 10% with the new sales tax, how does that actually achieve affordability? Because I'm going to argue that it doesn't. The third thing was, as we mentioned, the local cities and counties have concerns. The fiscal note doesn't address the cost of planning this out with and paying for some of these projects to the local cities and counties. And then finally, the other concern I have as I wrap up, Mr. Chair, Representative Jones, is the Met Council ability to purchase and take on more land development, basically, is what they would be doing. As you'd mentioned, maybe they'd buy it and lease it back, and might be subsidized housing, it might be commercial property in that. And so those are kind of some of the concerns, and in general, this basically is, maybe you would agree, putting the beginning of a 15-minute city planning type of planning and centralized planning. So A lot of people across the state, a lot of people in my community have big concerns with that. So interesting concept. I think we can do some of our planning on our transit routes better and coordinate with MnDOT in terms of some of the examples you gave of if you're putting a road in and do the utilities and all at the same time. We talked about that a little bit last year with Chair Cagle, and I think those are good things to strive to. I'm not comfortable with the overall mandates in the bill to get us there. So those are my comments. I know we're laying it over, but those would be some of the concerns that I have to oppose it if there was a vote.
Thank you, Chair Kosnick. Closing comments, Representative Jones.
Thank you, Chair Tabke and Chair Kosnick. To your one question about why not do this in every MPO, good idea. I hadn't thought about that. I'm just most familiar with the Metro because that's where I represent. So just closing comments, you know, this bill is designed to really have good governance of our transit system, of our construction dollars, of our transportation dollars. Of the issues that I've laid out here, I'm really open to suggestions for how to solve it. This is one way that I've thought about and that we have been moving forward with. The other thing I want to say is actually was a quote from Chair Nash the other day. I think it was either on the floor or in State Gov that you can't manage what you don't measure. And so it's really important, I think, for our transit system that we start putting those performance measures out there. And these other pieces around transit-oriented development, this is really taking from the most successful transit agencies around the world. And so I don't like to reinvent the wheel. Let's take things that already work, and hopefully we can do that with this bill moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, House File 4449 is laid over. Now moving to House File 3486, Representative Frazier, Chair Frazier. This bill will also be laid over. And Chair Frazier, please explain your bill when you get settled.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair and co-chair committee members, I do want to say I don't often get to go to Transportation Committee, so I enjoyed that robust conversation the minute I was sitting back there. Thank you for that. thanks for the opportunity to present House File 3486. This bill establishes a new Minnesota special license plate category for National Panhellenic Council fraternities and sororities, allowing members and supporters to proudly display organization-specific Panhellenic plates. The National Panhellenic Council was born out of necessity. For much of our nation's history, black students were excluded from colleges, universities, and traditional Greek letter organizations. In response, African-American students created their own, founding what we now know as Divine Nine in the early 1900s. The nine organizations are Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity, Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Kappa Alpha Psi Fraternity, Omega Psi Phi Fraternity, Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity, Zeta Phi Beta Sorority, Sigma Gamma Rho Sorority, and Iota Phi Theta Fraternity. These organizations were never just social. They were built to promote scholarship, leadership, service, and racial uplift at a time when those opportunities were denied elsewhere. In 1930, these nine organizations came together to form the National Panhellenic Council, creating a unified voice and strengthening their collective impact. Today, that legacy continues across the country and here in Minnesota. The Divine Nine develops leaders, advance civic engagement, and serve communities every single day. House File 3486 builds on that legacy in a meaningful and truly historic way. Members, this is more than just a license plate. For members of the Divine Nine, this is a visible symbol of history, pride, service, and lifelong commitment. It honors organizations that have shaped generations of leaders, educators, business leaders, public servants, and community advocates. And for me personally, as a proud member of Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity Incorporated, this represents brotherhood, service, and a legacy I carry with me every single day here at the Capitol. This is historic. Minnesota has never formally recognized these organizations in this way, and it is significant because it affirms their cultural importance and creates a new way for members to visibly carry that legacy while supporting their charitable foundations. House File 3486 ensures that proceeds go directly to affiliated nonprofit foundations, continuing a long-standing tradition of service that defines the Divine Nine. Members, this bill is about recognition, it's about pride, and it's about impact. And I respectfully ask for your support as the bill moves through the process.
Thank you very much, Chair Frazier. We're going to do some your testifiers now as well. So Dr. Stephanie Burridge, followed by Aaron Abram. Please say your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Dr. Stephanie Burridge, Chair, members of the committee, Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Stephanie Barrage, and I proudly serve as the president of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Alumni Chapter of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Incorporated. I stand before you today in strong support of the Divine Nine License Plates Initiative brought forward by Representative Cedric Frazier. This moment is not just about a license plate. It is about history, recognition, and visibility. Founded in 1913 at Howard University, Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Incorporated was established by 22 women committed to public service and advocacy. Just weeks later, they participated in the historic 1913 Women's Suffrage March, demonstrating from the very beginning that Delta would stand on the front lines of justice. For more than a century, Delta has turned that commitment into measurable impact. Over 350,000 initiated members worldwide, all grounded in a mission of service. Millions of dollars in scholarship awarded to students, opening the doors for opportunity. Hundreds of thousands of annual service hours, strengthening communities through education, economic empowerment, voter engagement, and social action, which makes it a joy to be here today to speak to you. And that impact is not just national. It is deeply rooted right here in Minnesota. The Minneapolis-St. Paul Alumni Chapter is proud to be celebrating 60 years of service in our state to this community, 60 years of investing in students, supporting families, and advocating equity across Twin Cities. In addition, our collegiate citywide chapter is celebrating 50 years of service, demonstrating that this legacy of leadership continues across generations. This is what the Divine Nine represents, a collective legacy of leadership, scholarship, and service that has transformed communities across this nation, including Minnesota. This license plate is more than recognition. It is a visible acknowledgement of legacy that has shaped communities for generations. It ensures that the contributions of organizations like Delta Sigma Theta and the broader Divine Nine are seen, honored, and remembered. It tells our young people that leadership has a history, the service has a legacy, and that they are a part of that story. As a public service organization, Delta Sigma Theta does not simply serve. We lead, we build, and we sustain communities. Passing this legislation affirms that Minnesotans value that legacy. This is more than a plate. It is a public declaration of who we honor and what we value. So I ask you to stand with us, each of you, and help move this forward. Thank you for your time, your leadership, and your commitment to honoring the history and impact of service organizations across this state.
Thank you very much, Dr. Barrage. I apologize for mispronouncing your last name.
Oh, no,
but
you're fine.
Thank you very much for being here. Next, we have Aaron Abram.
Don't worry, I'm not going to read all of them.
Please say your name for the record and proceed.
I'm Aaron L. Abram, Esquire. Thank you very much, committee. My name is Aaron Abram, and I am a proud member of Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity, Incorporated. Currently, I serve as the vice president of Zeta Nu Sigma alumni chapter here in the state of Minnesota. Also, I serve as the parliamentarian for the Divine Nine Minneapolis-St. Paul chapter right here in good old St. Paul. I'm here in support of the bill to establish Divine Nine specialty plates in hopes that you will do the same. Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity Incorporated was founded January 9, 1914 at The Howard University in Washington, D.C. After great successes in many other locations and noting the need for another organization within Minnesota, highlighting brotherhood, scholarship, and service, the Zeta Nu Sigma Alumni Chapter was founded on September 27, 1977. With the first undergraduate chapter of Pi Eta at the University of Minnesota being established on March 15, 1985. Since that time, Brothers of Phi Beta Sigma have been responsible for the establishment of the Amos Haynes Scholarship in remembrance of a founding brother, with the intention of assisting young people through scholarships. Established an annual bowl-a-thon to bring community together, as well as other issues such as when the tornado hit North Minneapolis, it was Phi Beta Sigma along with other folks of the Divine Nine that were the first ones to come and clean it up. When the earthquake hit Haiti in 2010,
It was the Brothers of Phi Beta Sigma, along with the Hospitality House in North Minneapolis, that had Hoops for Haiti, where we sent a couple dollars. It wasn't a whole host, but it was the best that we could do in that time of need and showing of our support. While admirable, these actions are not exclusive to our organization. As Alpha Phi Alpha has an SAT and ACT classes every year for low-income folks at the University of Minnesota, the March for Dimes, or Babies, with Zeta Phi Beta Sorority Incorporated, annual blood drives by the men of Omega Psi Phi Fraternity Incorporated, and so much more. Our recognition only comes from the support of those that are either working with us or those positively impacted by our efforts. Minnesota has a strong tradition of recognizing organizations that contribute to the public good, those that invest in education, strengthen communities, and promote civic engagement. The Divine Nine embody each of these values in ways that are both measurable and lasting. Across our state, members of these organizations are actively serving our community. If you want to talk about a representative, look no further than Brother Cedric Frazier. If you'd like to talk about the Chief Equity Officer for the state of Minnesota, look no further than Brother Corey Boyd. If you'd like to talk about what we're doing for our young people with mentorship and 100 black men, look no further than Brother Carl Benson. We are serving our community in every capacity at our disposal. What makes these plates especially significant is that much of this impact happens, again, without formal recognition. These are organizations that have built a legacy of service, not for visibility, but for impact. This bill offers a way for the state to acknowledge that contribution in a way that is both appropriate and meaningful. Supporting this bill is also a forward-looking decision. As Minnesota continues to grow in diversity, it is essential that we recognize and uplift organizations that foster inclusion, leadership development, and community engagement. The Divine Nine have demonstrated a sustained commitment in this work, both historically and right here in the great state of Minnesota. Thank you so much for your time and your consideration in this matter.
Thank you very much. Anyone else in the audience wish to testify on this bill? All right, seeing none, we have a variety of amendments on this as well that we're going to go through in just a moment. Are there any questions? Was there another testifier? Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you there. Yeah, please. Thank you, Representative Cagle. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Tamiko Robinson. I am the proud member of Sigma Gamma Rho Sorority Incorporated. So thank you for the opportunity to speak. This proposed legislation is a powerful step forward in recognizing the legacy, impact, and continued service of our historically black fraternities and sororities across Minnesota. As highlighted in the initiative led by Representative Cedric Frazier, this bill would create specialty license plates honoring the National Panhellenic Council, commonly known as the Divine Nine, while also directing a portion of the proceeds to support charitable work led by these organizations. And that matters, because Divine Nine organizations have never just been about letters. They have always been about leadership. For generations, we have provided mentorship, education, advocacy, and pathways to economic mobility for black communities and beyond. This legislation formally acknowledges the impact and creates a visible statewide symbol of it. The positive impact on our communities will be both practical and powerful. Not only does it create a new funding stream for community-based initiatives, but it also increases visibility of the organizations that have historically done the work, often without recognition. It reinforces that culturally grounded leadership is not only valuable, but essential to building stronger and more equitable communities. For our fraternities and sororities, this is a moment of affirmation. It tells us that the work we have carried for decades, often quietly, consistently, and without fanfare, is seen, valued, and worth investing in. It also strengthens our ability to expand that work, especially here in Minnesota, where our presence is continuing to grow. Looking ahead, this legislation sets the tone for the future of historically black fraternities and sororities in this state. It opens the door for deeper partnerships with government, increased community investment, and broader public awareness of who we are and what we do. It ensures that the next generation of leaders will not only inherit the legacy, but it will have the support and infrastructure to amplify it. This is more than a license plate. This is recognition, this is investment, and this is the step forward to a more inclusive, empowered Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Anybody else? Make sure I didn't miss anybody else. All right. Thank you very much. So at the beginning of this session this year, Chair Kozik and I had made a handshake agreement that we weren't going to do any license plates or memorial bridges and roads this year, except for Melissa Hortman 610 Highway. With that, I had told Chair Kozik, I had told Chair Frazier when he asked me for a hearing on this bill, no, that we can't do that because we have a handshake agreement that we are able to, unable because of time, especially this session, to move forward with things. And there are a lot of memorial roads and bridges, a lot of specialty plates. And so when Chair Kozik scheduled a memorial road, then we scheduled a driver's license. And so with that, there are a variety of amendments that are here today. And so we're going to take these, we're going to lay them over. If whoever has that amendment just wants to talk, say what the license plate is, where the money will be going, then we'll pass it on, we'll amend it onto the bill and go from there. So Representative Olson, you have an A3 amendment. So I move the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A3 amendment, it's individual for armed forces. So currently, you don't get to say, I'm an Army soldier, I'm a Marine, I'm a sailor, I'm in the Space Force, I'm in the Merchant Marine. This, the acceptance of this amendment would then allow the creator, and this bill would then create the allowance for a license plate to be designated for each individual service member. Any extra proceeds from this would go to the Support Our Troops Fund, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. With that, all those in favor of the A3 amendment, say aye. Aye. Anyone oppose? The motion prevails. A4, Representative Olson.
Ah, that's me again, Mr. Chair. This is a special curling plate. So for those of you who don't know, the city of Mapleton is currently it has the oldest curling club in the entire state of Minnesota, and it is the fourth oldest curling club in the United States of America, created in something like 1857, somewhere around there. I might be a day or two off on my remembrance there, but Mapleton, Minnesota is in my district, and curling is foundational to them and what they do. And as a result, everyone, I would appreciate that we would accept this amendment to create a curling specialty plate. Now, just a little shout out, Aiden Odenberg, one of the individuals who was on the United States curling team for the Olympics this last year, is from Mapleton, Minnesota. So born and raised in the area, he played for Mapleton in that sport. That's where he learned his trade. And as a result, I hope that we can accept this and actually make a plate out of it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. All those in favor of the which one was that? A4? A4 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. And sorry, Representative Myers, I missed you with the A2.
Thank you, Chair Tapke. So this is just a winter sports conservation plate. A great way to promote clean water access to the outdoors, ice fishing, snowmobiling. It's going to go to support both people from an environmental perspective and an economic perspective, and I would ask people to support it.
All those in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. Chair Kozik, A5.
Thank you. This is for food banks. Establishes a fund and would go to for food bank assistance.
All those in favor of the A5 amendment, say aye. Aye. Anyone opposed, say no. Motion prevails. A6, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the rare disease plate. The symbol is a zebra. So based on the medical adage, when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. But rare disease says adapted for the zebra. Sometimes it's not a horse, but a zebra. So 1 in 10 Minnesotans have a rare disease. Takes 7 to 8 visits usually to diagnose it. We are in a unique opportunity here in the state of Minnesota. This money would be used by the Rare Disease Council and for the promotion of rare diseases.
All those in favor of the A6 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? The motion prevails. A7, Chair Kozik.
Mr. Chair, that's my amendment. It was, we provided you the wrong information on that. So if please, I would.
Are you seriously doing three?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I would like to have.
Go, ASAP.
If I can have closing comments real quick to justify the creation of license plates, I'd appreciate that too. This is an aviation specialty plate. This would be for anyone who would like to basically say I'm an aviation aficionado or appreciate aviation in the state of Minnesota. There is no fund that this excess fees are going to be going to. Everything goes to the public safety account.
All in favor of the A7 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? The motion prevails. All right. Real quick,
Mr. Chair. So the concept of these license plates, specialty plates, I think that previously the understanding of the cost, the effort, maintaining, and when you have a Medal of Honor plate in the state of Minnesota and there are currently no Medal of Honor recipients alive and driving in the state of Minnesota, some of us look at that and say, well, do we really need a Medal of Honor license plate in the state of Minnesota? Back in the day, it used to be really arduous. It used to cost a lot of money to design these plates. It used to be really arduous for them to store them. But in today's technology, the way we play the game today, we can easily have it online, database created, and we have it, we've got it stored. And if we are honored by having a Medal of Honor recipient in this state, we can easily print that bad boy out and send it in the mail. So I think that the way we need to start looking at specialty license plates in this state maybe needs to be different. Maybe we need to open it up, because this is one of those ways that Minnesotans can say, this is who I am. This is what matters to me. When you're driving behind someone and you see that they've got a veteran or a combat wounded license plate, you can say, that person served me. And it's a really great way of saying who you are and what you believe in, what you stand for. So I really like the concept of it, and I think that we're bringing the price of these things down. But also, Mr. Chair, if I may add, when we're doing memorial bridges, when we're doing memorial highways, we have other outside sources funding these. And so maybe in a way to kind of level the playing field and make everyone happy, we would say the total cost of the design of this license plate, this organization needs to pay for it. You know, I'm sure that individuals would be more than happy to donate the $5,000 it costs to design a United States Army license plate. I know there'd be a lot of legions who would love to do that in the Marine Corps, the same situation. I'm sure that the sororities and the nine here we're talking about, I'm sure they would be happy to fund that as well. And so maybe in order to make these less controversial, we should just move off into that and say, you want to pay for it? You can have it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Kosnick.
Thank you, and I know we're running short on time, so appreciate the time. Representative Olson's almost making me a believer in specialty license plates. But just as the chair of the committee, I'd reached out to Representative Tabke. He essentially was very factual in our discussion. I asked him about the license plate thing. He says, well, you did that, I did this. We left out a little bit of the discussion. We don't need to put that in the public sphere, I guess, but we can talk about it later in terms of the Memorial Road. But I just want to say, Representative Frazier, Chair Frazier, thank you for bringing this bill forward. It was not in my research that this was for the Divine Nine ones, and I want to acknowledge the work and the importance of that and apologize with the other plates that we have, that not to diminish the importance of those fraternities and sororities and the importance of those. So I want to make that point, and but also at the same point, if I knew Chair Tapke was going to be so agreeable, there are a number of other license plate, specialty plate bills. If you would have communicated that to me, we would have brought them all forward then, or do none. So anyways, my sincere comments to you, Chair Frazier. Thank you, Chair Tapke.
With that, closing comments, Chair Frazier. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Tapke and Co-Chair Kosnick. I do appreciate you saying those words. It changed what I was going to say in these closes. I appreciate that. This is an opportunity to recognize organizations that have been around. Many of these organizations have been around for over a century, doing the work, serving the public, serving their communities. And I guess with this, with all these amendments we added on, as usual, lifting all boats with the work that they do. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Frazier. With that, House File 3486 is laid over. All right, now we have governor's budget. We're going to do a quick overview of the governor's budget and not have much, if any, member discussion on it, so we can get through the two remaining bills that we have. Mr. Lee.
If I could just jump in real quick. I saw that you had this on the schedule agenda. We also were planning on doing this on Wednesday. So if members have some more questions, maybe we will have time on Wednesday for that. But thank you for putting it on the agenda without us communicating that.
Mr. Chair and members, in your packets are one-page, two-sided spreadsheet that says Supplemental Transportation Appropriations, House Fiscal Staff. And also, there should be a Governor's Supplemental Budget Recommendations, all funds by agency. The narrative format is from the Governor's budget, and the spreadsheet is a summary of the Governor's budget. Starting on the front page where it says Department of Transportation, there is a extension of an appropriation from 2024 that extends what is left of a $3 million appropriation, which is right now $2.75 million. Then under the Metropolitan Council, the governor recommends eliminating one of the two general fund appropriations. This is the General Transit Systems Operations Appropriation. And so it eliminates the amount in 2027 and in 28 and 29. And I should note that this general fund appropriation is in addition to another much larger general fund appropriation for Metro Mobility. And then the Metropolitan Council also receives money from the motor vehicle sales tax, metro area sales tax, federal funds, and transit fares. Then under the Department of Public Safety, there are three State Patrol-related governor's recommendations, the first being $1.92 million from the General Fund for State Patrol Operating Deficiency, then capital security enhancements for $10.8 million in this biennium and $5.4 million in the tails, and capital security screening specific to the Capitol building, which is $12.1 million in this biennium and $13.4 million in the tails, and these are all out of the general fund. Then there are a number of appropriation increases related to driver and vehicle services. I'll just read them really quickly. The credential integrity, and then some changes related to repealing a reporting requirement, then statutory appropriation related to replacing plates at the time of transfer. This was the governor's recommendation from last year. Then changes related to lien holders receiving vehicle titles, audit assessments, mobile ID, and repealing a same-day issuance pilot. So if you go to the next page, you will see various transfers and revenue items. The first one is lines 40 through 46 related to MnDOT using capital accounts in the airports fund for operations and maintenance spending, and that's about $550,000 one time. Then you'll see a recommended transfer on lines 47 and 48 from the driver and vehicle services operating account to the driver and vehicle services technology account, which is forecast to have a deficit in fiscal year 2029. That's $15 million being moved from one special revenue fund account to another. Then lines 50 through 55 relate to a governor's proposed change on auditing motor carriers. The estimate for that governor's change is increased revenue for the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. And so you can see the spending flows for the HUTD and constitutionally dedicated accounts below that. Then you can see other revenue item interactions for DVS items related to replacing plates at the time of vehicle transfer and the audit. The net total general fund is on the bottom of the spreadsheet on line 80, so that would be a $32.1 million increase in this biennium and a $21.3 million decrease in the tails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lee, and we'll have more discussion about that on Wednesday. So next we'll have House File 4180. Anyway, House File 4180 is up next, and we have a Representative Cincy Mayor, if you will introduce your bill. We also have a few testifiers, so Nick Benson, if you'll please go up, and Ryan Gogg.
Thank you, Chair Tafti and Chair Kosnick. This bill attempts to address the use of our airport for deportation flights in December and January of this year, and continuing on in a lesser way in the last few months. We have seen hundreds of our neighbors put on these flights. Currently, our system, which is using state resources, lacks transparency, it lacks accountability, and it really lacks safety. We are seeing that people are being transported both with commercial flights and with chartered flights by the federal government. Oftentimes, the families of or lawyers of these detained people do not know where they are going. They do not know when they're going to be on the flight, and there is a lack of oversight from any, you know, state government agency or any individuals of knowing who is on the flight, what kind of conditions they are in, et cetera. So this bill attempts to address that, and would like to turn it over to my testifiers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just so everybody knows, we're going to take 10 minutes on this bill. And so each testifier, we have three testifiers who have signed up. And so take 2 minutes on your testimony, if you would, please. And please, Mr. Benson, state your name for the record and proceed.
Sure. It's nice to be here. I'm Nick Benson. I'm a small business owner from Burnsville. I work in commercial flight data analytics, and I'm speaking today on behalf of Minnesota 5051. The Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport serves as the narrow end of the funnel for ICE's ongoing efforts in our region. Our neighbors detained with insufficient probable cause, given inadequate due process, and 70% of whom have no criminal record, are flown out of MSP. A small portion, including children and families, fly alongside the general public, hidden in plain sight on scheduled airline flights. Liam and his dad flew on a Delta Airlines flight to San Antonio before they were incarcerated in an ICE concentration camp in Dilley, Texas. The only reason we know the specifics about these logistics are because of our volunteers who put in the effort with the data request and get that footage. Most of the detainees sent away from their homes in the region are loaded in shackles on dedicated ICE Air charter flights, which load at Signature Aviation. Since mid-November, when we started regular observations at the airport, there have been 110 of these dedicated charter flights, loaded with a total of nearly 4,000 detainees. I've personally witnessed about two-thirds of those from the parking ramps there at the airport. As a community service, we document and share these numbers in real time, and we remain the only source of these data. No part of the federal, state, or local government, as far as I know, collects or publishes this data on a useful timescale. With a recent analysis of the FOIA data from the Deportation Data Project, our estimates were within 2.5% of the actual numbers. Our work was good, but we shouldn't have to do it. This information shouldn't be reliant on a cadre of concerned eccentrics like me. As written, the bill is a great start, but as it moves forward, I'd request amendments for a monthly report from MAC, loading and unloading in view of a webcam, and a few other things that could improve transparency and access to those flights as they operate here. And at a bare minimum, we need assurances that the airport's rescue and firefighting teams are aware that when ICE Air flights are here, so if an emergency happens, they'll be ready to render aid in a situation where the passengers' wrists and ankles are chained together and flight attendants have been instructed to abandon them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Benson. Next up, we have Mr. Gogg from Minnesota Department of Transportation. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Gogg. I'm the director of MnDOT's Office of Aeronautics, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 4180. The Minnesota Department of Transportation has several concerns with the bill as currently drafted and appreciates the opportunity to further elaborate on those concerns, which are categorized into two buckets. First bucket, the agency has concerns with provisions in the bill that directly impact MnDOT's operations as the state's aviation agency. And second, there are concerns with provisions in the bill that impact the state's system of airports, which MnDOT has responsibility for planning, developing, and regulating in coordination and partnership with the FAA. As it relates to MnDOT's responsibilities, the bill imposes new responsibilities that are significantly outside our core mission. These new responsibilities are related to the creation of a detained passenger form, collection and retention of data from these forms, and then collection of reports required from the state's fixed base operators. Further, the bill appears to limit MnDOT's ability to enter into agreements with airlines operating in the state of Minnesota. This places a significant burden on MnDOT to track and evaluate proof of evidence in meeting the provisions of this bill before conducting routine activities such as purchasing tickets for air travel for state employees. As it relates to our state system of 132 public airports, the provisions of this bill appear to be in conflict with at least two key tenets of the aviation relationship that exists between state and federal governments. The first tenet is known as grant assurances. These are put in place when an airport sponsor enters into an agreement with the FAA, typically to receive grant funding. There are almost 40 of these assurances, but specifically numbers 22 and 27, grant assurances number 22 and 27, which prohibit airports and their fixed base operators from discriminating in the provision of services and require airports and their fixed base operators to service government aircraft are concerning. This bill contains provisions that, if enacted, would likely put airports at risk of violating those insurances and thus put tens of millions of dollars of federal funding at risk, as well as the fundamental ability to operate the airports. The second tenet relates to federal preemption. Simply put, federal preemption in aviation dictates that federal law preempts state law regarding aviation safety and airspace efficiency, among a few other areas. This means that the state and or the airport sponsors and fixed base operators cannot interfere with interstate commerce, as well as the operations of federal agencies, and it appears provisions in this bill as written would create such a conflict. In closing, MnDOT would hope these points would be given careful consideration prior to enactment of the bill. Further, MnDOT welcomes the opportunity to meet, answer follow-up questions, and work together toward a bill that addresses these concerns. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gogg. Next up, we have Samantha Diaz from SEIU.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Samantha Diaz-Powell, and I'm here on behalf of SEIU Local 26, representing 8,000 property service workers, janitor security officers, airport passenger service workers, and about 1,500 workers at MSP. We offer our strong support for HF 4180, which aims to increase transparency for individuals detained by ICE. Over the course of Operation Metro Surge, we had over 30 members detained. Almost every single one had updated legal status and or no criminal record. We worked tirelessly to secure legal representation to ensure they received the due process they were entitled to. As soon as we learned a member had been detained, the countdown began to connect them with legal aid before they were flown on ICE Air flights to detention facilities in Texas, Louisiana, New Mexico. Most detainees are transported on ICE Air Flights, a network of small charter airplane companies contracted by ICE. Detainees board these flights in shackles that remain on them for the entire trip, creating serious safety risks. Reporting from ProPublica revealed that former flight attendants were instructed to save themselves and abandon detainees in the event of an emergency. This is especially concerning given safety accusations against Key Lime Air, a charter airline that performs ICE flights out of Minneapolis St. Paul Airport. Five former pilots of that airline reportedly quit over safety concerns. We have seen the human cost firsthand. One detained member, who is a diabetic, was denied access to insulin. They experienced a medical emergency on the flight and was hospitalized for days afterward. No one should face a life-threatening crisis simply because they were denied basic medical care while in custody. The public also recently learned that some detainees, including children, are transported not on ICE charters, but on commercial passenger airlines. Delta Airlines has remained silent on the egregious violations of basic due process and dignity we witnessed during Operation Metro Surge. Delta has told reporters that they don't have control over who buys their tickets. Delta has not found the courage to publicly say that what happened to Liam Ramos and Adrian Ramos was wrong and un-American, yet they did not remain silent when the OBBA was being debated. They were public champions. Now we are dealing with the consequences of that historic bill and their silence. Local 26, we remain supportive of HF 4180, and we urge you to vote yes, as this it improves transparency for the public, helps mitigate the crisis that we saw when due process violations occur, and this could also potentially save lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we'll have Chair Kozik and then closing comments from Representative Sensenmuir.
Thank you. Members, I would just the comments that were made in the testimony, especially from MnDOT, I draw your attention to that as big concerns. And then also there's two letters in our packets that were also posted online, I believe, the Airlines for America and NATA. And basically, because of the grants that we get at the airport, a lot of the job concerns that were mentioned, there wouldn't be those many jobs because we would lose an incredible amount of federal grants and our airport would be severely harmed on that. I am sensitive to the purpose of having the bill brought forward and some of the confinement issues that were brought up, but it's federal preemption and there's case law to support it, that this something similar to this was already struck down, I believe in Washington, by the Ninth Circuit in 2024. So we're gonna lay it over, I'll just leave it at that. I am sensitive to some of the issues that were brought forward, but this bill would not withstand court.
Closing comments, Representative Sensenbrenner.
Thank you, Chair Kosnick, for those comments. Wish we had more time to talk about this, would like to have continued conversation. You know, I think about a lot of the bills that we have brought forward trying to mitigate some of the harm that we saw in our communities from ICE and from federal actions. I appreciate that I hear from colleagues on the other side of the aisle, at least the recognition that things shouldn't have happened that way, right? And that things happened that were wrong. I'm glad that we agree that Minnesotans should not be taken from where they live, transported to Michigan, transported to Texas, where no one can find them, where no one knows who they are, especially if they are children. I'm glad we have agreement on that. I do believe that as a transportation committee with some oversight of the MSP airport, this is something we should continue to have conversations about, a system where people can be transported. No one knows their name. No one knows if there's a warrant for them. Sometimes they are minors. They are often in shackles. I do believe that we need to have more accountability and transparency for our airport system. So look forward to continued conversations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Sensenbrenner. With that, House File 4180 is laid over. All right, final bill today is House File 4227. Chair Sam Vang. I move House File 4227 to be laid over. Please proceed with explaining the bill.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. The other Sam is here as well. House File 4227 provides temporary exceptions for getting duplicate IDs or driver's licenses. This bill is in response to people having their IDs and documentation taken or not being returned to them after getting detained by ICE. There is widespread documentation loss because this is often a common practice for ICE agents to detain individuals, remove their belongings, and release them without their possessions. I heard a story where an individual presented their birth certificate to ICE and the federal agent took it with him. I heard stories where individuals were detained with their legal documentation, got transported back and forth out of the state, were released without their documents. There are many times where I had to advise my constituents, because I've gotten so many questions about it, on how they should carry their passports or IDs, whether they should carry whether they should carry their original documents or only a copy, because they don't trust federal agents with them, and it is very time-consuming and costly process to get new documentation. Many times I've advised people, both U.S. citizens or not, to make copies of their documents and to inform family members where they are and to consider the possibility of getting detained with those documents that may not be returned to them. And during Operation Metro Search, I had an individual who reached out to me that his mother, who came to the United States recently as a refugee, got detained by ICE with her legal documents on her and later released without her documents. ICE still came to knock on her door days after they've already detained and released her. And this time she has no documents to prove that she is a legal resident and lives in fear. And today, even though Operation Metro Search seems to have ended, I know there are individuals out there who have not recovered from its impact, who are still trying to find work, or return to work, rebuilding trust to take their kids back to school, for example. And this bill is meant to provide some relief for those impacted by ICE by allowing DMVs to waive duplicate ID fees for those who got detained. The first section of the bill, it creates a fee exception from October 1st through the end of January 2029. The starting date is meant to allow time for the Department of Public Safety to be able to implement this. And the second section contains a fee refund provision to direct the Department of Public Safety to issue payments to applicants who had obtained a duplicate license or ID between December 1st or October 1st. It will come from their operating account to cover the cost of refund payments. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Chair Vang, for bringing this forward. This happened to many of my constituents, and so this is a really important thing that we address and hopefully get done this session. Any, Chair Kosnick?
Similar to the last bill, I appreciate what the intent, and I do believe that this actually was even more significant than the previous bill in terms of affecting more people. Do we know how much this would cost the state, or I don't know that there was a fiscal note.
We do not have a fiscal note for this.
We don't have a fiscal note. Okay. So there would be a cost to it, and obviously, but I, again, I always appreciate your bills. So thanks for bringing it forward. We're going to lay it over, and I guess I would be curious to know what a cost would be and what DVS would say.
Any closing comments, Chair Vang?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to thank the committee for your time here and for giving this bill a hearing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, House File 4227 is laid over. All right, this is my last time with the gavel this session, so I just want to say thank you to everybody for being here and for being hearing a lot of bills. I'm really proud of what we have done. We wanted, as the House DFL side of the aisle, wanted to make sure that we were putting forward what the future of transportation could look like in the state of Minnesota and what things are important and to us. And we know that a lot of Minnesotans believe in the same way. And so we had an entire hearing on safety. We had an entire hearing on modernization and efficiency on DMV, an entire hearing on transit, and a lot of other bills on top of that as well. I'm still disappointed that we didn't have equal number of hearings this session. That is extremely unfortunate, I think, but it is what it is. Also extremely unfortunate that we do not have a finance bill working forward, and we still have time to fix that and to negotiate and work together on getting a finance bill figured out for transportation, because there are a lot of good things on both sides of the aisle that have been discussed and brought forward this session. So hopefully we can continue to think about that and do that this session. So with that, we are adjourned.